Hey, Daniel.
Hi, Dave. How's it going?
It's going pretty good.
So, just to, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, it was really unimportant. Continue with what you were saying.
So I'm Dan Foster, news editor at National Review Online, and you're Dave Weigel. Go ahead, introduce yourself.
I am Dave Weigel, political reporter at Slate Magazine, where I am right now. And if you see anyone walking past really quietly, it's because this is a busy news organization.
And
I don't know where you're filming from. I'm calling some phone number I don't recognize.
I'm live on location in New Jersey, beautiful sunny New Jersey, where I will be spending the weekend. But so I figure we should just jump right in. And
Yeah.
actually, my location here in New Jersey is related to this topic because it's been raining here for the last 36 hours straight. We got something like 3 or 4 inches of rain. All the rivers around here flooded. And then, sure
We're
enough.
offering free sandbags in D.C., which seems almost like a waste since we're going to be out of, if the government shuts down, so does DC, but they were there for the offering.
I might bring down my old Jeep and load up on sandbags. But it's been raining for the last 36, 48 hours. Then all of a sudden, Scott Walker in Wisconsin signs this collective bargaining limitation bill, and the sky's clear and the sun comes out and it's 55 degrees now. So I'm not saying there's a connection, but that's sort of my inkling. Why don't
I
we
think
talk
that had
about?
more to do with Planned Parenthood being defunded and God reacting to that. But all right, let's assume it's Wisconsin.
Let's assume it's Wisconsin for the purposes of
Yeah.
this conversation. So you were there like a couple of weeks ago, but you were there
A couple weeks
reporting,
ago.
and you've been following it pretty closely. I've been following it pretty closely, although I've been doing a lot of the piggybacking, blogging, commentating sort of stuff. You've been doing more on the scene reporting. So why don't you just tell me what your take is on how it all shook out and where we're heading from here?
Well, this was the outcome that looked likely at the very beginning of the process.
Right.
We didn't know how it was going to end. And actually, I think politically it ended in a way that was pretty advantageous for Democrats. So, this thing began, and I guess people can consult other Blogging Heads episodes to figure out how it began. The thing began because the governor was going to push through this budget repair bill that was going to, among other things, eliminate the right of collective bargaining for public workers and force, annual elections for them to keep their union going. This is something that had happened. When it's happened in other states, it's basically like destroyed the labor movement, or at least the public sector labor movement. Like in Indiana, I think it fell, from by 80% after they did this. So Democrats protested this. All the members of the Democratic Senate left the state because that was going to prevent them from voting on anything that had a fiscal component. And the way they got around this was, after saying they wouldn't do this, taking out the parts of the bill that raised revenue and passing it that way. Well, I'm sorry, not raised revenue, spent money. They were going to refinance. They took that part out of it. I was surprised a little bit because when I was there, they had talked about passing a voting reform bill as a way to scare the Democrats into coming back to the state, but they didn't. Because they would have had to split that bill up and take out a fiscal part of that bill. And this time, I mean, they were really just physically obviously fed up. I mean, they'd been facing protests that had made it very hard for them to work. They had media scrutiny they had never ever been used to before. Everyone was embarrassed. Everyone was angry. Every time there was a vote, as you've seen, people were shouting at each other. So the Republicans just basically put a tourniquet on it and ended it. And the bill passed. And I think the governor just signed it, and the sun came out. That's what happened. I mean, my banal political point is that this is not good the way it went down for Republicans. I've heard people say, "Oh, the best solution would have been if there had been a compromise and Democrats had come back." But actually, I mean, Democrats were kind of, I guess this is a comparison that biases anyone who uses it. I mean, not, I'm trying to be neutral here, but they're kind of like Rocky Balboa in the first movie, where he goes all 15 rounds, or I guess if you're less cliched, but you still want to stay with boxing, like, the in Raging Bull when he fights Sugar Ray Robinson, he never gets knocked down. It's like that. They actually did hold up. There are rumors that they wouldn't. They held up for weeks, and they can say they got screwed. And I've noticed that, like, the ads that have come out, already, I think, well, already one ad against a senator who might be recalled, call this a backroom deal. You know, and I feel like that's important for reasons I can get into, but I've been talking for like 2.5 minutes.
That's fine.
I have a little clock that tells me, oh, 3 minutes, horrible. So I want you to start talking about this too. I mean, how do you think it's going to play out?
Well, I mean, the first thing I wrote after the Senate passed it, after they chopped off the fiscal part and the Senate passed it, was that I was really, really worried and bummed out that this was a suboptimal. I mean, I was rooting for the bill. I think, you know, and I'd like to talk about the policy of it in a little bit about whether or not this will, quote unquote, destroy the public sector labor movement in that country. But on the political stuff, as opposed to the policy stuff, I agree this is a suboptimal conclusion. I think the best thing that I think the Republicans were actually holding most of the cards as long as the Democrats were in Illinois. I think that it was a messaging war back and forth. But the fact of the matter is that it's really hard to paint the Republicans as at fault for the kind of grinding halt to which processes in the state house came once the Democrats left and all these dirty hippies came in and started their sit-in. So it's really as long and protracted as that battle could have been. I mean, I guess I'm trying to game it out. I guess at a certain point, some people are saying, well, is Walker have it in for the union so much that he's willing to shut down all other business in the state and let this siege kind of drag out. But I really don't see. I mean, I didn't see the Republicans having to budge. I didn't see that coming up anytime soon. And I think, like I said, they were holding all the cards. I mean, your opponents are in another state at a Holiday Inn or something like that. So it's a suboptimal outcome, but you know, they're going to be hard pressed to. The left is going to be hard pressed, I think, to paint this as a real backroom deal. As far as the maneuver of chopping off the fiscal piece goes, they went to their version of the CBO or the, you know, Congressional Research Service. They went to their nonpartisan office, their parliamentarians in Madison, and they gave the maneuver a clean bill of health. So, I mean, I'm sure there will be some sort of half-hearted court challenge or maybe a full-throated court challenge, but I just my look at it doesn't suggest that at least the Republicans aren't at fault there. I mean, if their parliamentarian gave them the okay, it's hard for me to imagine any but the most activist court saying, no, we know more about your parliamentary procedures than you do. Now, there is this other thing that people have been complaining about the open meetings law in sorry, my other phone just rang there for a second.
Actually, my phone just rang too.
That's
I think
so
something
funny.
Else must have passed. Yeah.
I
silenced it. If people hear, if they want to identify the song and send their letters to blogging heads audio contest.
Will they get a free T-shirt?
Yahoo.com. They won't get anything. But you know, they could send the email. That might be fun.
Yeah.
They can tell my ringtone.
Well, I forgot what I was saying, but.
I mean, you were describing the public meetings law.
Oh,
I mean,
the public meetings law. Yeah.
This is all in the weeds stuff that actually kind of matters. But, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I looked at it, and that is there's absolutely no guidance. So basically, what it says, what the law says, is that you have to give 24 hours notice and also details of what you're going to talk about at any public meeting, and they construe what a public what a meeting is of political officials very broadly. I mean, to the point where if three politicians are in a room drinking cognac talking about politics, that's a public meeting. That's a meeting that falls under this law. But they say, look, you need 24 hours notice, but you only need 2 hours notice if there's good cause, and it really doesn't get much more detailed than that. So that's a spot where I see. I mean, what constitutes good cause, right? And that's a spot where I see. The courts could have something to say in this, but I think the more interesting battle will be the recall battle. And man, you blogged the other day that left-wing groups have already raised close to $2 million that they intend to funnel into recall efforts in Wisconsin. I mean, it's going to be a totally nationalized process, and it's not even near being over.
Well, it's I think Craig Gilbert, who writes for the Journal Sentinel, pointed out there have been 13 people removed from office in all of American history, and I think he might be off by one or two, but you know, there's 16 people who are facing recall challenges this time in terms of like somebody putting in paperwork and doing it. So I think that's what's going on here. I mean, we are not less than 2 years old, so we all remember, you and I both remember the healthcare fight. And it just, this is so eerily similar to it. I know the stakes are different and, like, people feel differently about a bill that that might impact them directly in terms of their healthcare than they do about a bill that might impact a teacher they know or something like that.
Right.
But the politics seem this to be the same because during that period in the healthcare fight, I think maybe Matt Iglesias has been pointing this out. Because Iglesias is he doesn't think there should be a filibuster for the same reason he wasn't really supportive of the Democrats fleeing the state. He also just pointed out, look, if you thought that Democrats lost their cards when Scott Brown won the Senate race, and that they had to give up on health care. They didn't have to. I mean, they lost this one political skirmish, and it became more difficult, but they still had most of the tools to do it, so they ran it through. And in terms of what the Democrats were doing, I mean, this happened throughout the health care fight. It was, it was 4 days, or maybe even less, Democrats suggested to Capitol Hill reporters that they could just deem that the health care bill had already passed.
Right.
Which is something that happens with non-controversial legislation, probably less under Boehner, but happens a lot. And this was an outrage, and there were threats of lawsuits. I remember actually, I think the first threat of a lawsuit against a healthcare bill serious was Ken Cuccinelli saying he would sue if Demon Pass was used.
Right.
And so was that illegal? I actually didn't see the case. It was illegal. It just sounded bad.
Right.
So the goal was kind of, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and putting it out there that this might be illegal. You know, we still know why Walker took so long to sign the bill. I mean, who knows if he was talking to lawyers, because Democrats have been going to the AG and trying to get opinions proving that this was illegal. But, you know, if they fail and, like, the court holds this up, that's just an argument to use with voters. And I remember when I was covering Scott Brown's race, and I covered other elections throughout 2010, you know, people were angry about what was in the bill. They were angrier than you might think about random process issues.
Yeah.
Like they were angry about senators getting special carve-outs for their states in, you know, Louisiana and Nebraska. And actually, like, Ben Nelson, the first ad I've seen against him, maybe it was like a web ad, Ben Nelson, Nebraska, one of the Republicans running against him, his ad is like all about how Nelson had got more Medicare funding for Nebraska and how this was corrupt.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you pretend, if you call something a backroom deal and you were against it, it has the force of, you know, you basically can reshape reality and convince a certain, you know, definitely convince everyone on your base that it was illicit. Maybe convince independents that it was.
I'll disagree only in the sense, I think you're right that people care more about process than, I mean, that was the line we heard from a lot of people who supported the healthcare bill, and from some who opposed it, frankly, that nobody cares about process. This is a loser. But I think, as you saw and as I saw just covering this thing, that people care about process at least while it's happening and for a little while after. And it would bring me up to another really interesting take I've seen on where this is going now that the bill's been signed is Ezra Klein interviewed, I think the guy's name is Lichtenstein, this labor economist. It was a really interesting interview, or labor historian. And the other day, we'll provide the link on the Blogging Head site. But
oh yeah, I keep forgetting to do that. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, his one of his points was that in other places where this has happened, where collective bargaining has been limited, yeah, you've seen the great diminishing of the power and political power and influence of unions, and in some cases, you've seen them cease to exist basically altogether. But it's a foot race. It's a coin flip whether what we're seeing now, which is this massive outpouring of rage and money and lawsuits and recall efforts from organized labor and its adjuncts on the left, is going to get to the throats, as I'm badly mangling metaphors here, but is going to get at the Republicans before, you know, inertia takes over, before the law takes effect, before this becomes the status quo, and before the institutional results of it see their power diminish. So I think that's the most interesting dynamic of this, is what you're actually seeing is, let me just throw one more bad metaphor there, but, you know, there's the unions have been wounded and they're bleeding out here. So, but can they exact their revenge before they finish bleeding out? And so, you know, I think that's going to be really interesting to watch. And I also should say, and this gets kind of, again, I think, to the policy of it, that a lot of people, you know, I call this Madison syndrome. You've heard of Stockholm syndrome, but I called this Madison syndrome on Wednesday night, which is that I'm amazed by the number just of people around me, and it's totally anecdotal and unscientific, but people around me who I would consider.
Well, that's the best kind of reporting from my experience.
Absolutely. Because it's easy. It's easy and it's fun. But
colorful.
Just anecdotally, the people on my Facebook, friends of my old friends of mine, people on my Twitter feed, just people people I run into and talk to, who would describe themselves as liberals, but more surprisingly, moderates, really do believe that somehow their interests as future or current members of the middle class are intimately bound up with the success of public unions in Wisconsin. I mean, I think it's a magnificent trick, and I'm not even trying to be sinister about it, but I think it's quite the feat that kind of has been pulled off in post-New Deal America, that all these people really think that their fates are intertwined with the fates of public sector workers in Wisconsin. That's just not the case. I mean, we can get into, you know, to what extent public sector compensation, public sector benefits were a contributing factor to the deficit in Wisconsin. It's certainly the case that across the country, they're really a problem for state and local governments. So I think there's a good policy reason for taking them on, but I will yield, and I'll admit, and I said this to other folks on the left that I've debated about this, is that, you know, this was to a certain extent a power play. Of course it was. It's Republicans who are seeking to diminish the power and influence of organized labor on Democrats, but, you know, it's illicit influence. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. So it's not pure power politics, but that's one piece of this puzzle. And if labor power is diminished as a byproduct of really fixing something that's draining the resources of state and local governments, then, you know, I'm all for it. But it was a power play. So you're, you know, at the same time. So what we're seeing is, who's going to, you know, have the last laugh here? Who's, like I said, is the union movement going to bleed out before it can exact its revenge? Because there are plenty of other states that don't have collective bargaining. As every blog and its sister has been pointing out, that federal workers don't have collective bargaining. Most federal workers don't have collective bargaining. And also, for people who worry that this bill is going to destroy, you said that earlier, that it's going to destroy labor. Well, it's going to severely limit its political influence. That's for sure. But it's not going to, I don't see any reason
well,
why.
Well, it will lead to fewer unionized public employees unless they overturn it. Yeah.
Well, that's true. Well, that's certainly true.
That's what happened in other states.
But it won't destroy the structures for organizing public employees. I mean, in other words, since they will be allowed to collectively bargain on certain things, you're not going to see just the infrastructure itself for organization among public employees torn down. You will see them able to accomplish less. Their dues will go down. People will elect not to join them. What, you know, why should they? Because if they can only negotiate under inflation and et cetera. But it's not like you are fundamentally disbanding or disallowing people's right to organize. So I don't know that this will totally destroy. And also we should, you know, keep in mind that there's plenty of layers of civil service law and worker protections are still in place that will be untouched by any of this. So the main thing I think this does is give local governments a little bit more control over their budgets, which they're going to love. And especially if this thing is allowed to stand and operate for a few years, it's hard for me to think of a mayor who's not going to love the tools that this bill gives them. And it's also going to, of course, limit the power of unions.
No, I think you're identifying that a lot of the discussion, Wisconsin and elsewhere. I mean, again, inside the capital of Wisconsin, people were protesting. A lot, there was some on-message talk, but I mean, as I kept pointing out, there was just, I think, for everything about the actual issue, there was this sign about the Koch brothers or something. This became a proxy for a bunch of class war arguments. Right. And I remember there's the very good labor journalist Mike Elk, who's a former labor organizer and works for Michael Moore, I'm not sure. You know, was saying, you know, I think on Twitter, that Walker had lit the dynamite for the class war, which is Now we can argue over who started, but that's actually what it has become. I mean, I saw a lot of liberals. I saw on MSNBC, Michael Moore, giving a speech that was broadcast on there, and then going on Rachel Maddow to kind of amplify the speech. And his argument was, again, one part about unions, because people love to point out he's not a union-friendly employer in his own work. And it was, you know, one part that and 93 parts class war, which was, his speech in Madison a week ago, this era Saturday, he saying, the country is awash with money. It's just not in your hands, which is just a pure redistributive, Leninist argument that I feel like, I was about to say you don't hear that often, but it's something that liberals feel like they used to be able to say, and they aren't allowed to say anymore. Remember that fight they had about Obama saying we could spread the wealth around?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then pointing to polls saying, actually, most people are for this. Well, at some point in 2009, that stopped being the case, and for a lot of reasons that they can't quite identify. I mean, there's a lot of essays trying to take to ID this, they don't get why people are angry at AIG and angry at banks, and yet there are people who are they're willing to punish right now, and the people that that governors are able to punish are public sector employees.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, like that's a big reason why these budgets are in a hole. But another reason is that a lot of portfolios were invested in stuff that went belly up because of the banks blowing up the economy. I mean, they keep trying. I mean, it's just a very angry and frenzied and passionate argument. They're like, look, you should not punish these people. And that's where it begins. It's not even about a few years down the line, will a public sector employee have a decent pension and have a job and be able to have a good quality of life passed on to the next person. I mean, it's more than that. It's just they don't deserve to be punished. Why are you punishing them? It's become much more of a my class against everyone else fight than a fight about what the bill was in Wisconsin.
Right, but that's,
and go ahead.
And I think that there's been a lot of successful. I mean, this is what I've seen. Like I said, just anecdotally, but there's been a lot of successful demagoguing of this issue, so that there is a kind of class consciousness and a connection drawn between these public sector workers and just the middle class writ large. And the middle class is one of my least favorite constructs. I think it's more evil has been done in the name of protecting the middle class than
everyone thinks they're part of it.
Exactly, because the middle class is whatever audience a politician is speaking to, right? And so this is why you see it's easy to demonize the rich because nobody thinks of themselves or very few people think of themselves as rich. I mean, 98% of this country doesn't think of itself as rich, and so it's easy to do that. But the fact is, and this goes back to what I was talking about, this false consciousness, this among just the average middle class that somehow their fates are intertwined with public sector unions, when in fact, if you look at, I mean, the private sector unionism has declined, so sharply over the last 30 years, and we don't live in a feudal society as a result of it. I mean, I'm sure there are folks on on the left who would be interested in contesting that, but I'm going to assert it as non-controversial that we don't, in fact, live as a feudal society as a result of the decline in private sector unionism. Now, the place where unionism thrives and survives is the public sector, and people have to start to wonder whether or not that's because, they've captured the very politicians who negotiate with them and sign their paychecks. I mean, there's a mountain of evidence that suggests more or less that that's the case, but despite all of this, this fight, I think, is really, I mean, you saw the public opinion polls in Wisconsin. This is a state, all three houses of the legislature and the Supreme Court, for that matter, are controlled by Republicans. And yet 60%+ of those polled supported maintaining the status quo in terms of collective bargaining. So if people who are interested in challenging the grip of public sector unions on the people who sign their contracts, if they're interested in breaking that grip, well, then we have a really big and intimidating public education problem ahead of us. Because, like I said, I mean, I'm just amazed by the number of people who really think they're in the same boat as folks who have a guaranteed pension, you know, after 20 years of service and don't have to pay anything into their health benefits and, you know, negotiated pay raises year after year after year after year and amazing job security. You know, I'm just really surprised that people identify with them.
I don't know. I mean, that again, this is stuff that's not really being grappled with because I'm even politically, I keep thinking if an argument is that this is going to destroy the Democratic Party, it doesn't keep them from winning elections. It's just, you know, a non-labor Democratic Party is one that has to rely more on donations from business. But it's still able, I mean, it's able to do turnout operations and what have you. It just doesn't have that one source. Oh, I mean, well, for example, Barack Obama, but, you know, Mitch Daniels broke unions in Indiana, or the public sector unions, and then Barack Obama won Indiana. I mean, it's possible to raise lots of money from other sources and just, you shift around what the party stands for. But,
I don't know. You look at 2008 and, you know, basically, my colleague Kevin Williamson did a great breakdown on this, but basically it's the top 10, you know, sources of funding for both parties were Goldman Sachs, AT&T, three PACs, and five unions, essentially. I mean, it was a huge factor in 2008. I mean, of course, and Barack Obama famously had big support from Goldman Sachs. But it was a huge, you know, it was a huge source. So I think, in the very least, if you're right, then emphasis on the point about the Democrats having to change what they believe in. But I would argue that you've also seen that, and who knows where the chicken and where the egg is on this, but the decline in private sector unionism, mm-hmm. which I would also suggest is due in large part to the success of the original kind of purpose for private sector unions, which was reasonable working conditions and wages that are, you know,
And you're talking about the growth of SEIU and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I would argue that at the same time you have the growth of SEIU, but it's kind of an outlier, and because of how wildly successful it is, politically at least. But the trend has been over the last 30 years a sharp decrease in private sector union membership. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that has coincided, or that did coincide, with the great move to the center of the Democratic Party, sort of after their liberal heyday. I mean, I think that dynamic changed a lot during the Bush administration. But I would bet if you put, you know, two charts side by side and you saw a decline in private sector unionism and the rise of the DLC and the Blue Dogs in the 90s, you'd see a pretty close correlation. So I don't know what the chicken is there and what the egg is, but if you're right that the Democrats can win without public sector unions or without any kind of powerful union presence, then it's only going to be because they really redefine who they are and what they stand for.
This is true, but and I guess we can eventually, you know, change topics at some point, but I mean, I guess go back to what liberals talk about when they talk about this. And that's like most of us trying to get in Wisconsin was just to figure out why people were protesting, which sounds like a, you know, easy thing to do, but it wasn't that they were protesting this bill, they were protesting this idea. And it was very much they would just, you know, hark back to data about how in the aughts, you know, in the end of the Clinton era and the whole Bush era, in the first year of Obama, I guess a better way of looking at that is in that economic cycle where we came out of this one recession, had 9/11, then had a phony boom.
Yeah.
You know, wages were pretty flat. People were not better off in most of the country than they were before. Poverty was higher, and unemployment was higher in 10 years, and there's just this searching for a way to get out of that. And so I think the public sector unions have filled this gap the way. No, let's frankly, you know, the Tea Party did not have all the answers for why people felt economically anxious in 2009. They captured some of them, but I mean, again, a lot of the appeal of the Tea Party was that government is stupid and wasting money. Government is corrupt and passes bills without reading them. and government is working in concert with big companies that rip you off. That was a huge part of it, you know, the outrage against AIG that led to them getting their money clawed back, the idea that Tim Geithner worked for Goldman Sachs rather than Goldman Sachs. I mean, the right had captured not just, you know, the independents who go back and forth are not all sober about it. I mean, they have a lot of anger that they're placed in one thing or another. And so far, like, naturally, they've still mostly aligned it with Republicans, but Republicans grabbed this uncertainty people had about the future of the country and this feeling they had that they were not better off. And the Republican answer was, if we cut government and unleash the creative capitalism that's out there, we will be better off. Trust us on this. It's worked before. The Democratic argument really hasn't changed either. Now, the Democratic argument's like the Walter Mondale argument, basically, which is that we need stronger unions and a safety net with no holes in it, and anything less than that is an assault on not just the working class, but everyone in this country who's not wealthy. So, I mean, I feel like the elections are happening over the next couple months in Wisconsin to see. And if the Democrats win this stuff and recall some people, that's, you know, we're not going to be able to ignore this.
Right.
Special elections are flawed as indicators of anything, because I feel like Democrats will be more keen to turn out in these elections, just the way, you know, the way that if I'm a Massachusetts liberal in January 2010, I could give a damn about Martha Coakley. My party's in power. We've already got most of what we want. And as far as I know, the healthcare bill is passed. Or if I'm a conservative, it's life or death. You know, same thing. I think you're going to see a reaction here. But the bigger political issue is whether the left can capture, while Barack Obama's president, like, you know, this class and economic anger. I don't know if it totally can. I think in some places it's going to. But
well, I think
go ahead.
I think that Stern's genius was, and he's not hiding this. His genius was that he was able to successfully convince the rank and file, and also the kind of
Andy Stern.
Yeah, he was able to convince the rank and file, but also the power players in big labor that they had to sell the entire liberal progressive package. They couldn't just focus on things that were sort of parochially important to labor. If they wanted to maintain relevancy and also wanted to be big power players in the Democratic Party, they had to sell the whole package. But like I said, they're an outlier. They're a big, huge, expensive, important outlier. But the fact is that history has been kind of moving against them. And I guess it could be the case that this thing in Wisconsin is a wake-up call and it re-energizes the labor movement. But, and moves us in a different direction. But yeah, that's the thing, is that they're selling a liberal progressive story, and if those answers don't satisfy the people who the economic angst, as you put it, of independence and this, you know, vast middle of this country that feels somehow like they were left behind and are being left behind in this recovery, then it's difficult to see where they go from here, you know.
And that's what we're going to keep coming back to, that we can't quite see where they can go. I mean, I put my money on the one angry movement that was in the streets last year, and then so I'll temporarily put my money on this one, but we'll see how long it lasts. But
yeah,
you know, I'm glad we really were able to go into this, but I think you and I are both also paying close attention to a story that got buried immediately by Wisconsin,
right,
after like 3 months of hype, which was the inaugural Peter King Homeland Security hearing on Islamic radicalization in America.
Right.
So you're in New York, usually you're in New Jersey now. I was in D.C. I attended most of the hearing. I mean, I saw it all. It was such a media. I was about to use a word that has a curse in it. What's another word? You ever do that where you literally forget what the non-curse word is for something?
Firestorm. I don't know. Crap storm.
Yes, firestorm. That's the one. It was such a media firestorm that, you know, your movement was as about as limited as it was in like a TSA line if you were trying to go grab somebody to talk for something. So I saw the rest of it from elsewhere in the Capitol, but I saw the start of it from there. and saw the huge queue of people in the halls and watched the whole thing. And like, my opinion on it was basically, I'm not sure if I'm using my article, but I thought it was a whiff when it was over. And I noticed this morning when I walked past my city's major metropolitan newspaper, the Washington Post, the cover of the paper was, or the front page, sorry, was Keith Ellison, the first Muslim congressman who had given a theatrical speech in the very beginning of the, you know, a testimony. He's not on the committee. He just came basically to win the morning of him weeping as he told the story of a 9/11 hero who was a Muslim, the first responder is a Muslim. And the story was something about how the hearing didn't reveal much except it revealed something about Congress. I mean, it was hearings are pretty stupid generally.
Yeah.
They're most, but insofar as they have any value, they're, I feel, ways to get people that you could not normally talk to answer hard questions.
Right.
And that embarrass them. I mean, like, other Republican committees in the, on the House have been doing this really well. Like, you know, just bringing, yesterday, you know, James Clapper kind of fumbling some questions in front of Senate Democrats. He's the DNI. That's been powerful. Getting executives to talk about their packages, that's powerful. Getting, you know, Tony Hayward during the BP thing.
Yeah.
You know, this, like, I thought, like, gee, I mean, and we, people were asking, like, reporters were asking afterward, gee, this is all about Muslim radicalization. Everyone says there's these groups that do it, but you didn't have any of the groups that do it. I mean, it was pointed out that they kept saying CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, was called a terrorist group at the hearing, but no one from CARE was there. And we asked King, I mean, somebody else asked the question, because I wasn't that part of it, why did you not invite CARE to show up? And he said, well, they have an easy enough time of getting their message across in the media, so we didn't need to invite them. I don't know why that didn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think
go ahead.
I think that that you're right that it was a very underwhelming hearing. Now, the optimistic follow up to that is it's going to be the first of at least one more, probably several more. But I think King was painted into a corner where he had to make this as anodyne as he possibly could because so many people were kind of questioning his intentions, and there was such a funk about the hearings for so long that I think he had an interest. And, you know, and I spoke to him on and off the record about it. And there's such a sense that this was going to be incendiary or, you know, borderline racist or xenophobic that he was pushed in the direction of making it as uncontroversial as possible. So what did we get? We got the Democrats called some witnesses. They called the two members of Congress and the sheriff out there in Los Angeles County.
Rebecca, yeah.
Yeah. And but the Republican witnesses were family members of people who had of young people who had been radicalized and in at least one case, you know, died fighting for Somali jihadist group. In the case of Hassan, Burhan Hassan. And so what you got was this kind of heartrending, but at the same time sobering testimony and from these members of the family, but of people who had been radicalized. But you're right, what won the morning? It was the heartrending, sobering testimony from Keith Ellison. And this, I mean, yeah. it is a thing that people talked about coming out of the hearing, and it's demonstrative. And here's why. I mean, I'll just say I'm a total sentimentalist, and I'm a sucker for stuff like that. I watched Ellison tell that story. I mean, it just brought back all these memories of, you know, I was in the suburbs of New Jersey on 9/11.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
And, you know, brought back all these memories of that day and how scared everyone was and how there was all this paranoia after it and how big was the conspiracy. People forget the anthrax thing happened close on its heels. People forget that, like, a few days later, they evacuated the Empire State Building on a bomb threat. You know what I mean? Everyone, we kind of all thought it was the end of the world, kids in high school anyway, like I always did. And it brought back all these memories and, you know, and watching Ellison, you know, pay a really kind of, you know, heartfelt tribute to this guy. was powerful stuff, and the partisan in me said, you know, ah, damn it, he just hijacked the hearings. But it's demonstrative, and here's why. My colleague Matt Schaefer at the National Review did a great piece yesterday, and he pointed out that just about everything that Ellison was suggesting about this young man was absolutely blown out of proportion, absolutely false. So what he said was,
well, yeah, he did, but I mean, a lot of the proof was Google, and he was unable to find people smearing him on Google. And so I feel like what Ellison was using were the memories of the guy's mother, which
was being interviewed by the FBI, right? I mean, that was the big thing. So you're right. Schaefer did documentary research on this, but the sole source of this idea that he was, you know, that this young man was smeared after 9/11 or was thought to be in league with the terrorists was this New York Post piece, which was reporting on the fact that since he was missing after the attack, he was part of a pretty basic and standard operating procedure, dragnet by the FBI, where they went and they spoke to his family and asked him about any possible radical associations.
Right, and that was important to draw.
Yeah, what sort of websites he went to and things. So it's important to say that, you know, how many hundreds of people were subject to similar questioning right after 9/11. This is just sort of the nature of how we respond to big, massive events like this, as we try and cover all of our bases. But it's not the case. I mean, the important thing, I think, in Schaefer's piece was that here was a guy who was singled out as a hero at every possible turn. He's got he's got scholarships and things named after him. He's been singled out by Congress. He was singled out by President Bush. I mean, he's a guy who absolutely paid the ultimate sacrifice to help fellow Americans and was by all accounts a proud emergency, first responder. But it's not the case that his name was besmirched or something, in any kind of systematic way, the way that Ellison was suggesting. Yeah. I mean, the irony is that
when Bush was saying that, I feel like liberals are actually kind of wistful for the way Republicans talked about Muslims in 2002,
right?
2001, 2002, and they feel like it's gone off the rails since Bush left office, and the guys who run the conversation on Muslim radicalism are, you know, Frank Gaffney and Pam Keller and people like that. I mean, they feel about what the retconning is,
yeah,
in pop culture when you go back and make things, you know, change the way things happen,
right,
to reflect what happened now. I'm not saying Ellison did that, but it felt like his presentation was almost more about like, how
it was about Muslims. 2011, yeah.
It was about 2010. It was about the Ground Zero Mosque and stuff like that, more than it was about the way, you know, the hypersensitivity that existed in reaction to, like, you know, real abuse after 9/11.
That's an interesting take. The two other things, though, that stuck out on me on this score about to what extent could we say fairly that there was xenophobia or racism or something behind these hearings. Like I said, I don't think the hearings were tremendously impactful. No. Go ahead.
Well, I actually do think King bent over backwards to make them not incendiary, and that's why I don't think they were very useful.
Right.
Because the problem with this topic, I mean, he's right. He said after the hearing that I think we were successful in breaking down a wall of political correctness, and I think me and one of the freshman Republicans said, like, use the exact same word. And this is I'm very sympathetic to that. I mean, I think this is one of the stupidest debates we have in politics, because it. Democrats did not cover themselves with glory by using every opportunity they had for questions to just claim that the hearing was about hatred of Muslims. When, you know,
right,
there are witnesses in there who were just trying to reject the entire premise of it. Their point was that having the hearings in themselves would make Muslims more skeptical and more fearful of interacting with the government. And that's one of those arguments that sounds very true and is incredibly hard to prove clinically, you know?
It's not, like, it's not just hard to prove, but it strikes me as cognitively dissonant to an extent,
yeah,
because there aren't supposed to be, it's not supposed to be a real problem, but the act of holding the hearings to investigate it are supposed to worsen the problem, right?
It is dissonant. I mean, Muslims are patriotic Americans who love their country, but if
this
you raise any
questions
them, about
yeah,
them, they're going to clam up and not talk to you.
Right. And the other thing is, I mean, I think it's important, yeah, and I wrote this the other day, it's important, and it's not a novel observation, but it's important to say that if you read the NAACP letter about this, for instance, They went on and on. They condemned the hearings a couple days in advance of them, and the NAACP letter went on about how it was irresponsible to pin the blame for extremism on one racial or ethnic group. But precisely what the hearings are doing is singling out an ideology. Now we're not going to have our heads in the sand. It's an ideology that is predominantly found among people who were born into the Muslim faith, but it's produced extremists. I mean, the catalog, and we have what we hope is the full extent of it over the last 10 years, the catalog of American-born or American-naturalized jihadists and Islamists is United Nations. I mean, it's mm-hmm. Pashtuns and Arabs, but also white kids, wealthy, you know, suburban white kids, black kids, Hispanic. I mean, there was no element to that extent of in that sense, there was no kind of racism or ethnic bias underlying it. Now, by its nature, it did focus on the Islamic faith, but it focused on an ideology within the Islamic faith. And I know this is all pretty banal and non-controversial stuff, but it actually bears repeating because you know, this was painted as some sort of somehow anti-Muslim. But of course, all the witnesses were Muslim, you know? All the witnesses mm-hmm. that King called in to testify were Muslim. So, not that that's supposed to be any great demonstration of good faith, but I just think that's such a simplistic, and you put it well, it's such a simplistic way of going about this. And the Democrats didn't cover themselves in glory. Sheila Jackson Lee talking about how holding up the Constitution, talking about how this plays into Al Qaeda, how a guy talking about how he lost his son.
I think those guys are. I mean, they've already told their stories to local media, right. But they put themselves out in front of cameras again in a big setting, and maybe made their lives more dangerous. I don't think it's right to deride them like that. I mean, the problem. Yeah, I don't think the media. No one did. I don't want the end of this to be. I think you and I did a good job, and everyone else sucked. But I mean, like, even though the media coverage was like, wow, they really talked a lot about the scandal around the hearing at this. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, if this was a hearing about some anodyne topic, though, like, I remember there was a hearing 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago. I remember because it's the only thing I've ever seen Herb Kohl make news about.
Right.
Herb Kohl runs the aging committee in the Senate, and he had a bunch of victims of elderly abuse show up, including Mickey Rooney. Right. And actually, like, the coverage of that hearing was that there's this problem called elder abuse, and we interviewed some people who say they've been victims of elder abuse. And that's usually what happens. Like, the point of a hearing where you get some people to tell their stories is to, you know, it's kind of a stupid role of Congress
it's
to do this.
It's consciousness raising. But
it's consciousness raising, you know, it's a teach-in, basically.
Yeah.
But this didn't get covered like that. So that was why I was saying, if you're going to do this, and you're serious about getting the rest of the world to take seriously the things that they don't take seriously when they come from, like, Frank Gaffney, about whether foreign interests are funding terrorists, you know, radicalizing people in America. Because there have been people arrested for doing that. There was the Holy Land Foundation trial. Right. There was Al Moody in Virginia. If you want to do that, you know, invite CARE and invite some of these charity leaders and invite people, or invite FBI agents who deal with this and explain that issue. Because it is... When I talk about the political correctness thing, this really is a stumbling block for the media covering this, because it is true that if you cover this in a sloppy way, or if you covered it at all in some ways, you're going to get accused of bias.
Right.
Everyone does this. I mean, if you cover Tea Parties in a way that they don't like, they're going to accuse you of bias. Everyone does this, but it's especially sensitive when it comes to Muslim issues, and the media does a pretty lousy job. I mean, indeed, I think it's better if it's a congressional committee introducing people to this than profiles of Pam Geller, if those are the options. But yeah, it just seems weird if you have this power and you have the Homeland Security Committee now, not to use that to invite people and grill them on documents and get them to disprove the documents that show that they were at a meeting in 1993 that was connected to this. Or
right, the God.
When,
the
I,
God
when
Father
I read about
too,
it, it's very tough. Oh, sorry, but I'll finish up.
Yeah.
When I read about it, it's tough. I read a piece a couple weeks ago about you know, the Muslims CPAC controversy, and the truth is, like, some of the guys who are accused by people of, you know, programming conservative movements to accept radical Islam, like, some of the stuff they're accused of is true, some of it's just false and it's been proven false, but if it's on the internet, it never dies. And, like, to understand it, you need the reporters who understand it to spend years going into FBI records and FOIAing things and going to trials. It's complicated. I mean, it's hard to cover. So if, you know, Congress wants to investigate this, then do a good job investigating it. Sure. Like, the consciousness raising, if the argument is that, like, this is a good way to start it, I guess. I don't think Congress should have to do, if, as long as we're cutting funding for things, I don't know why we would do that, but, no,
that's
like,
a fair point.
Find out. Go ahead.
That's a fair point. I think the question that I'm left with, and you do a good job of leading us to it, is, well, what's Peter King's real angle here? What's his end game, right? I mean, I think, certainly, Homeland Security hawks, national security hawks, and people who worry about Islamism between our shores hope that this is something more than consciousness raising. But you point out that, you know, If it were really about directing the conversation somewhere, then, you know, you get somebody in there and ask them some tough questions. So the other thing that hearings are often used for, I was thinking about this as you were saying it, is not just consciousness raising, but you often see a chairman hold hearings that in some way magically reinforce the argument for his pet project, right? Or for pork, mm-hmm. right? You see this all the time with the less sexy committees, for instance. They'll orchestrate testimony that supports whatever stupid agricultural subsidy they happen to favor.
If I ran ag in the House, I'd have some kind of like pig free hearing, you know?
Right, exactly. So
and just invite a bunch of black farmers to show up.
We want to talk about Pigford again. The last Blogging Heads I did.
Do you have two more hours?
Yeah, the last Blogging Heads I did with Adam Sir, where we talked about Pigford for 45 minutes. Yeah. I think the guy who was editing it fell asleep. But that's the question, you know, that we're left with on King is what's next, you know, and are there going to be more hearings? Are they going to be juicier than this one? Are there going to be more fireworks at them? And more importantly, what I want to know from King is what are you going to do about it? What's, you know, if this is a real problem, some of us think it is, you know, if this is a real problem, what are we going to do about it? And then that's where you get into some real meat and potatoes controversy, because now if you're talking about taking actions to somehow try and mitigate the success or the outreach or the impact of Islamism, or on the other hand, if you're taking positive steps to try and improve, I don't know, law enforcement relations, you know, that's purportedly one of the problems. I can't speak to it intelligently, but to enforce law, you know, to improve law enforcement relations with the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, tell us what you're going to do. I mean, that'll be the interesting thing to see. But you're right. I think what we're both left with from this hearing is, okay, it wasn't that controversial. There were some parts that were interesting. It was maybe an interesting topic to talk about. But what's next? Where do we go from here?
I think we can all agree on that. I mean, I'm just glad there are reporters who do this. I mean, and because it's thorny and it almost never pays off, and a lot of the reporting's bad. So there's some role for investigators there, I think.
Yeah.
We're going a little bit long. It might be Friday, but we both need to finish work before the 40 days of flood come in.
Absolutely.
I need to gather up some. I think I'm on tiger and giraffe duty for the ark before we all get swept away.
I always get and stuck with the fire ants, man. I always get stuck with the fire ants.
You just need two of them, though. That's not tough.
That's true. But you keep killing them, and then you have to find two more. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Good talking to you.
Likewise.
Yeah.
Have a good weekend. Bye.
You too.